listen to the show on your smartphone, just go to gcnlive.com and click on Listening Options. Once again, here's Elizabeth.
Right now we're talking with David Soucy. He wrote a book about the Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, why it disappeared, and why it's only a matter of time before this happens again. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thanks for having me.
So where's the plane?
That's a good question. I wish I could answer that simply. I really do. But it's definitely, in my opinion at least, out in the ocean. It's out in there, and they just keep trying to look for it, but starting to feel like they can't find it, like they may not find it.
You wrote a book about this plane, and you don't know where it is?
I didn't write a book about where the plane is. What the book is about mostly is about why it disappeared. Why is it that an airplane with that many people on it can just simply vanish and no one knows where it is? And it's unfortunately not a very unique story. It happens more often than, of course, anyone would like it to happen.
How often does it happen?
Well, we've had at least two or three that have disappeared recently and then not been able to be found. But they did find a couple of them after the fact. The point is that with technology the way it is today, let's say that this aircraft crashed and it did a ditching, a successful ditching, such as what we had in the Potomac River. If the passengers were survived, it would have taken weeks, possibly, for them to locate where the airplane was, and those survivors would have certainly perished at that point. So my concern, and the point of this book, is why is this technology out there? Why is this technology there and not being used?
The technology is out there, so why are they feeding us this complete bullshit about this plane?
I agree 100%. In fact, if you look at Air France 447, which was, 4 years ago now, and nothing's been done to improve it, Air France, civil aviation authorities in France, everybody's been begging for this technology to be used.
Well, Mr. Soucy,
tracking and streaming everything.
You and I both know that not only are the black boxes on the planes, but the engine itself pings. We know that they know where the freaking plane is. And it's really frustrating because there's over 200 people that died or could still be alive somewhere.
Who knows? Yeah, that's right. I don't believe that they're alive, Elizabeth. I have what we call a theoretical probability matrix that I've used for about 20 years as an aircraft accident.
Sort of like an Occam's razor thing?
It is exactly that. It uses a Bayesian model, a Bayesian theory model of looking at all the possibilities and weighing all the information against itself. And so in doing so, using seven different experts from different perspectives, we've come to the conclusion amongst ourselves that the aircraft did have a fire on board the aircraft of some kind, disabling the pilots, disabling the crew, and then also asphyxiating the passengers. So we believe that the passengers did asphyxiate within minutes of the actual time that the aircraft disappeared.
Do you think it was hit by a missile? Do you think this was a terrorist event? What do you think?
I don't, actually. What I think it is that there's been history in this particular aircraft and this particular airline, actually, of a poorly attached power wire that goes to all the radios and communications equipment.
This was a Boeing plane, right?
It is. It's 777.
Okay.
And they've had some fires in that aircraft before in this area, but with that likelihood of the fire, I don't think there were survivors at that point. Nonetheless, if there were, and there's a possibility that one or two people may have survived because there is emergency oxygen available on board the aircraft, so there's a possibility that either the crew or some people would have had access to that emergency oxygen, which is used for medical use on board the aircraft, and so they could have survived for a few hours.
Why would we not be told this information?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think that partially the ICAO, which is a part of the United Nations, which is the aviation branch of the United Nations, ICAO tries to keep
people happy about flying.
Well, that is one for sure, but they also want, for about a year, they say, don't release any information in their guidelines. They say, don't release any information until you have the full picture. Well, we may never have the full picture of this airplane.
Well, this is really interesting. In case you're just joining us, we're talking with David Soucy. He's written a book called The Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, Why It Disappeared, and Why It's Only a Matter of Time Before This Happens Again. Why do you think it might happen again?
Because nothing's been done, Elizabeth, and this is the terribly frustrating thing about all this.
Yeah.
Especially for the families and loved ones of these victims of the airplane.
Yeah.
Is we even going back to Air France 447, again, three or four years ago, this aircraft disappeared. And it took 2 years before they ever found any evidence of the aircraft where it was.
See, that's just crap to me, because you and I both know they know exactly when it happened, where it happened, why it happened. They know where it is right now.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that they do.
How would they not know that?
Because they don't have the technology in place to tell them exactly where it's at. And that's the frustrating thing about all this.
Do you really believe that?
I really do. I believe that they have technology to narrow the aircraft down, but they also have technology that's not in place that would tell us exactly where it was within minutes, within seconds, literally. And this is a technology that's been on ships and for years. All the ships that are crossing that area of the ocean, they have these EPIRBs, emergency position indicator radio beacons, and they float. If the ship goes down, these things touch the water, and as soon as they touch the water, they start emitting a signal on the emergency locator transmitter frequencies of 406 megahertz that say, here I am, and then there's 15 satellites circling the Earth that triangulate that position and tell the Coast Guard exactly where that ship is within seconds of that beacon touching the water. Now, why we don't have that on aircraft is just preposterous to me.
Not only that, we tested the cell phones after this happened. The cell phones still rang.
Well, now that's a little bit misleading, because the fact that the cell phones rang means that they actually tried to connect, but they did not connect. And so that can happen through the cellular network itself. It doesn't necessarily have to have a cell phone on the other end.
We tested it both ways. It did not ring when it was not able to connect. I used to write test cases for computer companies. I tested this. He hung up.
That was bad timing.
I think, well, this happens to us all the time, so I'm not really surprised that our phone call was disconnected. The point I was trying to make is that we tested the cell phones both ways, and the cell phones still ringing was significant in our eyes. I know they tried to say it was not.
Right.
But we believe it was. And the reason is because when the cell phones were off and we tested it that way, the cell phones did not ring.
See, what I don't understand about that is that because of the range, I mean, it's simply the range of cell phones on the aircraft in that location.
But they're like giant
GPS.
They
have the indicators that they weren't in that location.
Aren't they GPS finders? I mean, if I walk down the street with my cell phone, everybody knows where I am.
Yeah, but that's because you're within a certain number of miles of three different cell towers. If those three cell towers don't connect and don't know where you are, then it can't triangulate your position.
Okay, if that's true, how do I call France?
You're close to a cell tower on your end, and then from that cell tower to the other cell tower in France, have a connection.
Through a satellite.
Actually, a different satellite.
Through a satellite, exactly. But
your phone doesn't go to the satellite. Your phone goes to the cell, and then the cell connects to the satellite, not your phone.
How's that possible?
Because you only have 0.5 watts on your cell phone, which is only capable of a certain amount of range. So that range has to be within 20 miles of a cell phone tower to receive that signal. And then a repeater uses that to transmit that to the satellite. And then the satellite sends that through a repeater to another satellite station, ground station in Paris. And then from Paris, it transmits within 20 miles to another cell phone tower, which connects to the cell phone on that end.
Okay.
But as far as the cell phone itself being able to connect, unless you have, 150 watts of power, the range wouldn't be there. And I'm convinced that the aircraft was the satellite pings where the aircraft connected to the satellite, which is called the SATCOM system.
Right.
That SATCOM system connects directly to the satellite, and then the satellite connects to the ground station. So those pings were happening, but they were ringing, and then they answered. But when they answered, no one was there. There was no data coming from the aircraft. And so they used that to determine the location.
My point is that there was a footprint, though.
There definitely was. But what that footprint tells us is that, yes, here's the aircraft, and here's where it stepped, and here's where it went. And so it tells us exactly where it was. What the problem is here is there are so many different assumptions that are being made based on what was going on the aircraft. For example,
like what?
There's about five different autopilot modes that the aircraft could have been in, and very well could have been in, based on operational characteristics of the aircraft. One of them is flight heading and hold mode, in which it would just continue to fly at the same heading, same hold, everything else. Well, we know that wasn't on because the aircraft made several turns after it disappeared. So we know that wasn't on. What we can assume from that is that also it could have been in just heading mode, which again we don't think because of the way it went, but it could have been in attitude mode hold,
right,
which means that the aircraft stays in the same configuration.
There's altitude and attitude, right.
Yeah, so, and there's another airspeed mode. It could have just been in airspeed and been trimmed out to continue to fly in the right area or in the right flight attitude. Mm. But the most likely one is this one they call efficiency mode. Now, efficiency mode, what it does is as the aircraft burns off fuel, the center of gravity changes in the aircraft because, you know, the fuel in the front is being burned off first and then the back. So as that happens, the aircraft, you know, tilts up or tilts down. And as that happens, the engines actually go faster or slower. So the speed changes to make sure that the aircraft's in the most efficient mode. So if it's in that mode, then there's a lot of variables because it depends on how much fuel is being used, how much headwind there was, how much tailwind there was. All of that can affect that. So in calculating where the aircraft is in efficiency mode, there's so many variables, and that's why they have this incredible, huge range of areas to search, because if they had a little bit of a headwind that wasn't recognized on the charts, which could be out in that area, then it could have slowed down, it could have sped up, it could have changed attitude and speed, and that affects where the aircraft would have gone down.
Don't you think that's sort of a leap of faith, though, that they're saying, okay, we kind of know where it was, yet we don't know where mm-hmm. it is?
Yeah, exactly. Well, they know based on these calculations and assumptions, if you change that assumption just slightly, ever so slightly, it could be 50 miles in one direction or the other.
Yeah, but that's not a very big area.
Oh, I'll tell you, if you're out there on the ocean and trying to look for something in 50 miles and the ocean is 5 or 6 miles deep, it's a huge area. And what it takes to try to get down to that level. And, it, you know, to complicate that, here's the big question for me, and this is what raises a lot of suspicion in my mind,
okay,
is the idea that that aircraft actually landed and didn't create debris. And I've never investigated an accident.
Well, yeah, where's the debris?
Some kind of debris. And that's where the big question really comes in, and that's the one thing that even my algorithm that I used to try to figure out what happened here
did not compute.
It all points to this kind of event, but it just didn't match. Why is there no debris? It would have had to be a miraculous...
There'd be something.
Like flight on the Potomac type landing. I mean, in that aircraft accident, there was no debris because the aircraft landed in one piece. And that's the sad and most tragic thing about this.
Well, yeah, because where's the people?
Exactly. If it landed in one piece, then here you go. You know, there's this aircraft that landed in one piece. Now, likely there weren't any survivors on the airplane, but then again, it doesn't compute because if there were no survivors on the airplane, how did it land in that mode? Because it can't, it's not designed to land that way.
And I know you don't believe me on this point, but why did their phones still ring when the relatives tried to call them?
Yeah.
I think we should leave it there. I think people should buy your book and get a real picture.
Well, there's still questions.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
And get a real picture of the analysis that you did, because I think from talking with you, I mean, I'll be frank with you. I was really kind of pissed off about talking with you because I'm really frustrated about the plane in general,
mm-hmm.
that nobody's done any analysis, but you did.
I did. And not all of the analysis is out there, and that's going to create a little bit of problem too. But what I'm going to do, we're going to post this online, hopefully by the anniversary is the idea, and people can go on and do their own analysis using the data.
Why isn't the analysis out there? Some of it classified?
It's not classified. The reason that the only way that it's legal to classify anything is if they suspect criminal activity, which they do not. So if that's been ruled out, the fact that this data is not out there or that the analysis is not out there is just people protecting their own selves.
Okay.
You know, as far as saying, hey, I did the analysis, but I don't have enough answers to stand behind it. I didn't want to do that either because, you know, Sarah Bajak and I have talked a lot. Her partner, Philip Wood, was on board the aircraft, and Sarah Bajak has been speaking about this quite a lot. And I spoke with her, and she encouraged me to publish the book, just as you have, because of the fact that it's an analysis. It's not an answer, because there simply are no answers. People who claim they have answers do not. There's too many questions still out there. It's still a mystery. It may be for years a mystery. But this way, at least you have, what I've narrowed down is the facts. I've got about 150 facts, and you can weigh those against themselves,
okay,
by themselves, at the anniversary and see what you come up with.
Very interesting. We've been talking with David Soucy. He wrote a book called The Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, Why It Disappeared and Why It's Only a Matter of Time Before This Happens Again. We thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Have a great day.